Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Bill Mullen about plasma cosmology, Velikovsky, Egyptian hieroglyphics, and, well, really the big picture of the emergence of modern man and what happened in the past. And it's a very interesting scenario, of course, when you begin to think about these things of how things unfolded and the unlikely yet, you know, miraculous timing that certain things occurred on, just as you kind of ended on there. But we'll see if we can go back to that specific topic as well and see if we can tie it in. But I wanted to just ask you a little bit before we do that. You mentioned that there were basically 81 plasma shapes that Peratt had replicated in laboratory conditions. And then you mentioned that there were about 300 hieroglyphics. And so are there any of the plasma shapes that have actually given birth directly to some of the hieroglyphics that we can see? Or is it all interpretive and symbolic?
Well, look, I will keep that as a question as I go through the hieroglyphs. I think that the question is answered on a much larger scale by petroglyphs, because Peratt sent his team all around the planet and found on every continent ever inhabited petroglyphs with these plasma shapes, these 81 plasma shapes on them. And he even did work with GPS to see what direction they were facing. By the way, another person I would like to boost here is someone who was on his team checking out the petroglyphs globally, and that's Marius van der Sluis. We call him Rens, R-E-N-S, and he has his website Mythopedia. So instead of encyclopedia, say Mythopedia, and you'll find all kinds of visual imagery that he's collected, a lot of prose giving the basics that would be one of the best ways to be introduced to the whole plasma physics, plasma cosmology paradigm. So I would like to put a plug in for that site. He's a very prolific writer, so there's a lot to be found of his work in print as well. But you're asking about websites, and so I'll mention that one.
Definitely. And we've had Rens van der Sluis with us as well, by the way. We talked about the shapes and everything, and he's done a very good job at, again, decoding and cross-referencing the mythological record and everything. And it's I'll link that show up for people as well, so they can listen to that as an introduction. Very good stuff.
Okay, well, I'd love to hear it myself. I mean, I have the highest admiration for his work, and he's a young scholar who has just untold potential. He's already developed a great deal of it. He's written book after book. So I'm glad that you interviewed him.
Indeed, yeah. Now let's see, should we carry on and see if there's more we can go through? We've talked about some of them, and certainly, as you said, you're going to do a whole talk on the Eye of Horus alone and the connection to everything, but you want to run through some more examples?
Yeah, and then I have another larger topic, which I talked about last year, which I think is very relevant to plasma cosmology, namely complexity theory. And so why don't I reserve that for a little later in this segment?
Sure.
But for now, I'd like to read some more blood-curdling, stirring, catastrophic passages from the pyramids. If you can give me a second here.
Certainly.
The famous cannibal hymn, where the king eats his celestial forebears to gain their powers, is in the Pyramid of Unas, and I've got it. Now remember my essential construct from the old wisdom, as above, so below. You can add, as in myth before, so in ritual now. So let's say that catastrophic events occurred, and humans made stories about them. Isaac Dinesen, the South African writer, is famous for her statement, "Nothing is too terrible to bear as long as people can make a story about it." All right?
Right.
So in addition to making symbolic forms like petroglyphs or the Eye of Horus, they were telling stories like the one I read, Hathor's Destruction of Mankind. Now, if those stories are about the past, then worldwide you find that rituals reenact the past and ask their participants to embody these figures from the past, or in a more radical sense appropriate to the pyramid texts, they take the king as the center, the ultimate high priest, and the king at his death and rebirth as the critical time in which he embodies and unites himself with the powers that were great in the past and destructive in the past. He becomes those bodies in his rebirth. Okay? So if you have this construct in mind, then it might just be possible to understand why, in these obscure pyramid texts, the pharaoh, when he's reborn and starts to mount the sky, to ascend to the sky where the great gods are, and become those great gods, or be embraced by them, or travel on their boats with them, all of that is done by a cataclysm. That is, his ascension to the sky reenacts the primeval cataclysms. So let me just read you a few lines from from the spells for his spirit's rebirth. As he enters the region of the sky called the Akhet, obscure, but it seems to mean the radiant region. We could talk more about it. In any event, he's ascending to the sky. And here's how it goes. The sky has grown cloudy. The stars are shaken. The sky's arcs have quaked. The horizon's bones shaken. And those who move have grown still, having seen Unis apparent and his soul as the god who lives on his fathers and feeds on his mothers. Unis is the lord of jackal-like rapacity, whose own mother does not know his identity. For Unas' nobility is in the sky, and his power is in the Akhet, like Atum, his father who bore him. And though he bore him, he is more powerful than his father Atum. For Unas' Ka's are about him, his guardian forces under his feet, his gods atop him, his uraei on his brow. Remember, the uraeus is the swelling cobra, and it's on the brow of the pharaoh now. For Unas, lead uraeus is on his forehead, a soul when seen, and a radiant figure for shooting fire, for Unas's powers are on his torso. So you see that the ascension to the sky makes everything shake and tremble and grow dark.
Yeah.
And then the uraeus, the flaming uraeus, swelling and poisonous and ready to kill, certainly threatening to the max, is on his head. So everything that was seen and symbolized as uraeus and destruction in its powers is now put onto a human head, okay?
Right.
And the pharaoh in the ritual of his rebirth in the present is making present the terrible events of the past. So I think that that's one of the most famous passages in the pyramid texts, and it's frightening.
Yeah, is it? Do you think we have echoes in other myths about Kronos and the devouring of his children and other stories like that?
Right. Well, I don't know if I'm ready to make that connection. To me, the Theogony succession myth, where we learn about Kronos devouring his children, is part of this so-called succession myth, where first there's the sky god Uranos, and second there's Kronos, and third there's Zeus, who finally wins this succession struggle. And with the story there, the first thing that that's nasty among the sky god is that heaven, or Uranos, who might be another planet, according to Talbot, in any event, some reigning sky god thrusts his children into the earth. He buries his children in the earth, and earth groans and is angry that this is happening. Now, to me, that is a wonderful representation of bodies hitting the earth, coming from some celestial body, bolides or whatever, which cause huge earthquakes. Then Kronos devouring his children is the opposite of some sky god who now ejects material from him, which then comes back to him as though he were eating these things he gave birth to when he ejected them. It's then only Zeus, by command of the lightning bolt, electrical discharge, who wins the permanent, or we hope permanent, kingship of the sky.
Right.
So that's part of the succession myth. I don't know if I'm ready to connect it with the cannibalism of Unas. It's a pretty unique passage, actually.
Right.
Though I'm sure if you went fully afield throughout the planet's lore, you could find other examples of powerful leaders who eat their enemies, or who eat something which gives them the power of what they eat. That's common enough.
Right. Yeah.
Let's see. I think I have a few more passages about the Eye of Horus, which might be scary enough. Let me see here if I can get it in a second. Here's an example of the king becoming Horus. And as Horus, he says, "I, Horus, will put flame in my eye, and it will encompass you and set storm among the doers of evil deeds, and its fiery deluge among these primeval ones. I will smite away the arms of Shu, which support the sky." So, translation. I is the king as Horus, the hawk, the martial god. The martial god will put flame in his eye, and it will encompass human beings and take all the evildoers and put them in a huge storm, just as the sun god wanted to destroy those humans who complained about his decrepitude and whom he thought of, therefore, as evildoers. And what he's sending out is a fiery deluge. And in so doing, he's going to make the sky collapse. The god Shu is depicted as holding up the sky. And if you cut off his arms, the sky will collapse. This is Chicken Little, right?
Right.
So it's all there in just, a few words. The king becomes the god whose flame sends fire and deluge among those people of early times, the primeval ones, And when that happens, the sky collapses.
Right.
So I could multiply at great length, and even better could Ev Cochran, passages where it simply says, the eye of Hathor, the eye of Horus, does this, does that, does the other, and it's always destructive, all right?
Right.
I think that that's helpful. Just to assure the listeners that there is a kind of happy ending to these macabre, catastrophic pyramid spells.
Right.
There is something which I actually translated while I was at Princeton into verse, and I have published it in the Bard Press, and I hope to someday get these Egyptian translations of the pyramid text together on my website. So just for now, I'll read it to you in the prose of James P. Allen, whose translation of the pyramid text is 2008, it's the most 2005, it's the most recent and therefore the most authoritative. What happens when the pharaoh has gone through his evolutions in his rebirth is that the oldest god, who is called Atum or Atum Ra, Atum means united, and it's, I leave it to Talbot and others to say exactly what this idea of the united God is about. And let me say right now that they have challenged the idea that Ra is always the sun god as we see the sun in the sky today.
Yeah.
That you're probably aware of all this, that some earlier god, very possibly Saturn, was the principal god in the sky and could have been called Ra back then.
Yeah.
And that word then changed to what became the principal god in the sky, our sun. And indeed, the term Atum Ra, the united sky god, could refer to the Saturn complex before it disintegrated. Just as for Perat, there's a long, stable period of awesome view of the sky, and then inevitably a disintegration or collapse. So in any event, Atum Ra can stand here as the oldest god, and what happens is that he's treated as the father of the king, and the culmination, what I'm calling the happy ending, is that the father embraces the son when the son goes on high. Let me just read that to you. The spells speaking to the pharaoh say, you shall gain control of your body without impediment, having been born to be Horus and conceived to be Seth, having become clean in the Western Nome, having received your cleaning in the Bubastite Nome, with your father, with Atum. You have developed, you have gone high, you have become effective. It has become cool for you. Inside your father's arms, inside Atum's arms. Atum, elevate him to you. Encircle him inside your arms. He is your son of your body forever. That sounds most Christian, doesn't it?
Right, right.
That after suffering on earth, the Son of God goes back up and sits at the right hand of his Father.
Mm.
And that's the happy ending of Christianity.
Interesting.
So, you know, the myths involving Horus and Hathor and the eye which departs from the brow of the god and rages and destroys do have happy endings, which we can understand the reality of. Namely, the eye returns to the brow of the god, and the fiery deluge from that eye ceases, the cosmos is pacified, and men can worship the eye, but no longer fear it. So suppose with Cochrane and Talbot, you have the planet Mars as visible in the polar configuration in the north, and suppose from it comes forth a comet-like Venus, and after its rampage, it wraps itself around Mars's circumference, the way the crown, a certain crown, is on the pharaoh.
Yeah.
Then it stops. This rampage stops. The fiery deluge stops, and humans rejoice, sometimes in orgiastic singing and dancing on mountaintops, that cosmic stability is returned.
Right.
And so just as humans need to find symbolic ways through stories and rituals and glyphs and representations of what terrorized them, so they find ways to celebrate the return or the new order. Okay. So
the new cosmic order of what we could witness in the sky. But have you seen anything in the text that seems to indicate that there is a wish for a return of the you know, that golden age when Saturn was close and you know, God was visible in the sky in that way?
Aha, that's a big question. Yeah. The golden age motif is, I think, not the strong point of Egyptian culture, for the reason that the order of Egypt as ruled in peace by the pharaoh is absolute and present. They don't want any competitors or nostalgia for some other age.
Right.
We all know it's a peculiar culture. As Cochrane quotes one of the Egyptologists, it's a very concrete culture because its very writing system is all pictures. It's not a culture with a lot of abstractions. And I would say it's a culture which has developed a whole system which celebrates the pharaonic divine kingship as in the present. And they're always eager for the order of the present, if it's disturbed, to be restored. For instance, if the king has to fight a battle against the Assyrians, he goes out, he smites them, and whatever actually happened, he returns saying he won, and they put that on the edge of their temples, on the outside of the temples. You can read a whole book of some battle, and it will always end with the return of order. This word order, you may know in transliteration as ma'at, M-A-A-T. It's a wonderful concept because it means both cosmic order and human justice, all right?
Hmm.
So justice is what is, as it were, visible and effective under conditions of cosmic order. There's a very interesting parallel, in the Greek theogony, where Zeus, when he has won this battle against the Titans and given birth to Athena to help him, then marries Hera and has offspring, but marries a whole set of other goddesses, some of whom have abstract symbolic names. One of them is Themis, which is tradition, precedent, or you know, the way we do things. And when he marries Themis, he has three children. One of them is good order or good law, and another of whom is the seasons, or Hora, seasonal time.
Mm-hmm.
The third is peace. What could that possibly mean? It would seem to mean that when Zeus unites with the way things are done in an orderly tradition, the result is not only good law and peace, but a regular recurrence of the units of time.
Right, yeah.
The hora can mean either the hours or the seasons. So it's rather like the ma'at of the Egyptians. In the event, I would just say that you've asked a very good question. I'll think about it more. A nostalgia for the golden age is not present to my knowledge if the golden age is about humans living in an environment which never changes.
Right.
The golden age would be this Atum Ra, the earliest god, about whom the Egyptians speculate a great deal, how he created the universe and so on. But his creation leads to the way things are, I think, and the way things are meant to be the golden age of Ma'at, which may be disturbed temporarily, but the pharaoh always, according to the doctored history, steps in and restores Ma'at, and we're back to a golden age.
Well, very interesting. Now, let's see if there's others you'd like to, continue on as you have found them in your work. If there's more, clear evidence that, we can see the connections between the language and the actuality, the story, the history of the catastrophes.
Well, trying to think of some of the others that might stand out. We've been talking about Atum Ra and Ra as the god who creates the universe, okay?
Yeah.
One of the famous stories, which again I'm reading right now with Budge on the right in English and the hieroglyphic text on the left, is called the Book of Knowing the Evolutions of Ra and of Overthrowing Apep. Apep is the serpent enemy of Ra, and Ra has to slay him every day. The description is of Ra at the very beginning in the form of the god of becoming or evolution, Kepera, at a time before the sky existed or the earth or the children of the earth or creeping things, and how this god created himself and created some other gods. And then there's a series of references to the eye of the sun or of Ra, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we're back to this eye, and I can see it on the page opposite as the eye. My eye was covered up behind Shu and Tefnut, but after two hen periods, some vast period of time, had passed from the time when they departed from me, from being one god, I became three gods, and I came into being in the earth. Then Shu and Tefnut rejoiced from out of the inert, watery mass wherein they were, and they brought to me my eye. Now after these things I gathered together my members, and I wept over them, and men and women sprang into being from the tears which came forth from my eye. And when my eye came to me, and found that I had made another eye in place where it was wroth at me, it raged at me. Whereupon I endowed the second eye with some of the splendor which I had made for the first eye, and I made it to occupy its place in my face, and henceforth it ruled throughout all the earth. So there's more to the myth, but can you see how it's obsessed with the eye of the primeval god?
Yeah, yeah, certainly.
So being more than one eye and the eye raging. So in a very cryptic way, we have the same mythology of eyes and raging and then peace, pacification. So that's another very famous text that I would adduce for this series.
Interesting. So let's see if there's another area to this as well, then, in terms of if we just go back to what we talked about, at the end of the first segment there, and see if what you have been able to tell in terms of migrations and such in, that early period is very interesting, and there seems to be different epochs of vast human migration. And if you believe that those primarily have come about because of the catastrophes, these might have even changed the climate in certain regions. So you have a vast movement of peoples during a certain time, because that, of course, leads to, cultural exchanges and everything else as well on top of it, which we probably can see a development of language or different skills or different cultural kind of preferences to kind of go along with that, right?
Sure. Well, when you get into migrations, you can start finding different kinds of them. Let's take a very well-known migration described in the Torah, particularly in Exodus. There, you have a population oppressed by another population as slaves, the Jews in Egypt. And the first thing they do when chaos comes in the form of the events in Velikovsky, later retold by others, is to leave the structure which oppressed them, right?
Yeah.
And one of the great books on this subject is, again, by De Grazia, called God's Fire, Moses and the Management of Exodus. De Grazia was a political scientist, and he brings all of his skills as a quantivolutionist, as he would say, catastrophist, and political scientist, to the idea that Moses managed the Exodus through a lot of force and sometimes through purges. In any event, the nature of the migration is ferocious, and of course the Bible gives a certain version of it, but even the Bible will tell you that when approaching the promised land, the Jewish people were told by God that the first people who tried to prevent them to get into the promised land, Amalek, the people of Amalek, the Amalekites, should be slain, man, woman, child, cattle, and ass.
Mm-hmm.
It's a genocidal instruction. Gunnar Heinsohn has written in German a short book entitled Encyclopédie des Volksmord, people murder,
yeah,
is the terrifying German word for genocide. So an encyclopedia of genocide, in which he astutely asks of each of the people in the encyclopedia, first, whether it was a victim of genocide, and second, whether it was a perpetrator of genocide. And all too many of the peoples are both. So for the Jewish people, after the terrible Holocaust where they're victims, as they have been so many times before, he goes all the way back to their own record of slaughtering Amalek, killing as many Amalekites as they could, man, woman, child, cattle, and ass. So that would be the most ferocious kind of migration, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
First of all, it's under conditions of terror, of collapsing society, and then of relentlessness in seeking out a new land. And if you encounter someone, it's not a friendly amalgamation into a new kingdom.
Nope.
here's another example. In various ways, Greek culture and memory speaks of how the Greeks came from the north. And they sometimes speak of the Dorian invasion. But earlier on, we had the great Mycenaean culture. And the question is, where do they come from? Because it's clear that they invaded and that they subjugated the preceding cultures. Most of the place names are, by one account, taken down from the north, and the few place names that are earlier from Greece have different formations in their endings and sounds.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the graves of the Mycenaeans, you find many a grave which contains husband and wife, to give it a nice modern bourgeois terminology. And the skull types of the two are regularly different. That of the man is long and thin, as in a Nordic skull type, like Max von Sydow, okay? that's called dolichocephalic. Cephalic skull, dolicho, long and thin. The wife, to give her a nice name, has a more pumpkin-shaped head, more common in the Mediterranean, which is called brachiocephalic, a broad head.
Right.
Well, they are husband and wife, but the situation, which is easiest knowing human nature to envisage, is that the northerners, from whatever part of the north they came down as men, all male, or mostly male. And they did it because, as a character in Herodotus says, pointing to his genitals, we can get wives wherever we have these. So I suspect that these brachiocephalic women entombed next to their lord and master were taken by in the migration by the men who came down with superior force, overthrew the superior culture, took the women of the superior culture as their mates.
Mm.
Yet again, this is a rather harsh picture of migration, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It seems to be, it was just kind of what happened at the time. It wasn't really, I mean, we can sit, I've said this many times before in other contexts, but I think we make a mistake if we look at history with our current moral lens, if you know what I mean. I think this is just the way things were done, right? You know?
Well, another even more basic way of understanding these migrations is that there's no way of knowing, when you see the things in the sky destroying things in your part of the earth, that it's destroying the whole earth.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe
exactly.
Things are better elsewhere. And so your civilization has been trashed by fiery deluges or whatever, you move in hopes of finding a more untouched place. Now, since on the thesis that these are global catastrophes, what you find out is that the devastation is everywhere. And though your encounter with other people might be crazed, military, genocidal or whatever, it might not be entirely that way. And one of the features of migration will be the encounters of peoples under catastrophic or post-catastrophic circumstances who share versions of what happened.
Right. Yeah.
At that point, you have the possibility of amalgamation of myths. Let me distinguish that from a way a lot of myth interpreters proceed when they say, oh yeah, myth, a Greek myth was obviously diffused from a Near Eastern myth. The diffusionist explanation of why the Greeks have this myth. They act as though diffusion is a process like osmosis, which will happen by nature inevitably, painlessly, and so forth. They don't ask why would the Greeks let themselves take over this myth from another culture. Let's say that they had more urgent reasons for comparing myths, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the desire to understand what happened would be very powerful. And since no one was telling what happened in a what we would consider a modern scientific materialist cause and effect way, because everyone conceived that powers like humans but much mightier were up there in the sky and affected the earth, then they would each have their story about humanoid gods and would compare them, you know?
Yeah.
So that could be one of the richer results of migration. And, you know, it's always said that trade, which is a form of peaceful, small-scale interaction, not fully migratory, because you go back home with your trade, is an excellent place for exchange of ideas as well as goods. Well, I would say that exchange of ideas in an earlier, still traumatized, maybe just post-catastrophic period must have happened a great deal too.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's a really good point. It's very, very interesting. And, you know, as well, we have to do that at a later stage, Bill. We have to have you back, you know, and talk more about the Baltic origin of the Homeric epic that you mentioned to me before. That's very interesting. And just, you know, to kind of just quickly go over that a little bit, is that something then that DeGrazio has written the primary work on and you've you translated this? Is that how it went?
No. It so happens that it was Al DeGrazio who introduced me to the book. The book is by Felice Vinci, and De Grazia invited him to a conference in Bergamo in Italy. And then he showed me the manuscript that winter, and I read it excitedly. And later met Vinci, and as with Velikovsky, I said I'd be happy to help him out in his work because his English is not quite as fluent as he would like. And he and I have traveled to various places in such a way that I am sure that the English in a you know dialogue he has with someone else comes out right. But more than that, I've sailed a lot and traveled a lot in Scandinavia. Let me just say what is relevant about his thesis to catastrophism.
Mm-hmm.
He is not himself any form of catastrophist. Nor chronological revisionist. He takes the conventional wisdom about what is called the post-glacial climatic optimum, or the Holocene optimum, in which in a long period ending around 2500 BC, the whole planet was 4 degrees Celsius warmer. Now, if you think about, you know, climate change predictors, they're terrified at much smaller changes than that. but suppose the Earth was 4 degrees Celsius warmer.
Yeah.
For one thing, the northern regions where you come from, Henrik, in Sweden, would have been paradises. I mean, they're yeah. very beautiful as they are, and all you have to do is turn up the temperature. I sailed with a Swedish fellow right out of the Royal Marines and 4 students of mine throughout the archipelago of Sweden and then on to Helsinki and back. It was so beautiful. It was in June, and the weather was not rainy, and we just had a wonderful time. And I kept thinking, oh, if this were warm,
yeah,
and if it's warm all winter. Anyway, he takes it that the climatic downturn starts around 2000 BC, and it is the cause for the migration south into various places, including that migration which led what we now call the Mycenaeans to invade Greece. Okay?
Right.
He's happy to argue that the climatic downturn, as it in its earlier phases, would produce wars, climate change produced famine, famine produced wars, and his notion is that the Trojan War can be mapped with great precision in an invasion by the peoples in what is now Sweden and other parts of Finland to an area near Helsinki, which to this day has the name Troia. Okay?
Right.
He finds everything about the Trojan War right there. Huh. Well, that's a whole separate story, but in terms of where he's coming from, it is not catastrophist. I think that his whole theory is only strengthened if the source for this migration were catastrophist. And the Iliad shows you the gods fighting in the sky and the gods intervening with human fights in a way, including Zeus and his lightning, and Poseidon and his earthquake and water overthrowing the Greek walls. These are things which go much better, in my view, with the catastrophist time frame and events as background for the Iliad,
right,
than a uniformitarian one. Huh. But in any event, there's enough to work on with Felice Vinci, even within his framework. And someday, if it's validated, it can be fine-tuned by being shown to be in a catastrophist framework, too.
Well, that's very interesting. We will definitely have to stay in contact about that, have you back, and talk more about that. It's a whole another subject in itself, of course. And well, in the meantime, then, Bill, we want to say thank you for coming on and sharing some of your work with us, some of your insights. And of course, again, we want to defer people closer to the websites that we're going to have linked up. And also, don't miss the Thunderbolts conference on the Electric Universe here coming up in 2014. It's in March. It's in Albuquerque, and a lot of good speakers, including yourself, Bill, will be there. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
Okay. They get bigger each time I come and more exciting. And so there's nowhere I'd rather be in a given year than at an Electric Universe conference.
Very good. Well, thank you again for your time, Bill. Really appreciate it. And we'll stay in contact and we'll talk more.
All right, Henrik. And thank you for your wonderful, lucid questions. I think we've had a great dialogue.
All right. There you go. A lot of things to learn. We have more coming with John King on the murder of Diana, Kong Pop Yu Yen on evidence of space weather-induced natural disasters, Barbara Peterson from Farm Wars, Karen Hudes from the World Bank, and also Christopher Bolin on solving 9/11, and David Icke on his latest book. We'll speak to you in just a few days. Please take care, and thank you for listening and for your membership. Couldn't do this without you guys. See you soon.